All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry. I was a chief warrant officer, second grade, I guess you'd call it, helicopter pilot in Vietnam in 1969. It seems like many, many years ago now. We want to welcome you to our program today. I'm really excited about it. I've got two great authors on who are going to be talking about their books, of course, but also today's program is pretty much dedicated to Vietnam. We've got another Rotorhead who's going to be on in just a moment to talk about his book and his journey home, which is a great story. I can't wait to talk with him. That's Richard Jellerson, and his book is called The Healing, and he talks about leaving Vietnam and how it took him almost a year to get home. So I want you to pay attention to that one. I think for all of you Vietnam veterans especially out there, this is going to be a really healing story for you. And then in the second half of the program, I've got a gentleman that I've talked to before here on Veterans Radio, and that's Mark Yablanka. And Mark's got a book about the correspondents and photographers who were in Vietnam, the military and civilian. And he's got some great interviews in here, and I think it's going to be just a most interesting interview from a different perspective, I think. I think when I was reading the book, it was really eye-opening to me to see how the photographers and the correspondents told their stories about us, you know, those of us that were there. And I think you're going to find that really interesting. So Mark will be on in the second half of the program, and then Richard will be on in just a moment. I just want to remind everybody that we are sponsored by Legal Help for Veterans and also by U.S. Wings. And U.S. Wings, the manufacturers of those really great leather flight jackets, and you can find more information about them on our website. You can also go to find out our other supporters, I guess you could say, and that's the local VFW 423, Post 423 here in Ann Arbor, Michigan, American Legion Post 46 here in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and the Vietnam Veterans of America, Charles S. Kettles, Chapter 310. We couldn't be on the air without them. Hey, if you'd like to support Veterans Radio, you can go to our website, that's veteransradio.net, and click on Support the Program. There are a lot of things going on with Veterans Radio right now. You can follow us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. You can, of course, go to our website and listen to all of our archived programs. And we are we have a huge list now of podcasts up. So wherever you are, whatever device that you're listening to, you can tune in to Veterans Radio. We're going to take a real quick break right now with a little commercial for Legal Help for Veterans. As soon as Derek can get that tuned up, I'm kind of surprising him today. How many of you have ever had your computer decide that it's going to update right in the middle of something that's important? Well, I just did. So that's why I'm going to have a little bit different bump music than I had planned on having. So anyway, we're going to be right back right in just a moment with Richard Jellerson here on Veterans Radio, and his book is entitled The Healing. Stay tuned.
I left my heart in San Francisco.
And we are back on Veterans Radio. I just had to get that last line in there because half of us who went to Vietnam went out through San Francisco, or we came back through San Francisco, which is even a more of an adventure. But anyhow, joining me on the line right now is a good friend of Veterans Radio. I have met Richard before, and his book is entitled The Healing. He was also a helicopter pilot in Vietnam. So I want everybody to welcome Richard Jellerson. Richard, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Dale, and thanks for having me on your program again.
It is fun. It is fun. I was looking for music. I think I found something that you had produced.
Quite likely. Normally, I'm doing documentary films, not books.
Well, anyway, we keep trying. Anyway, I want to welcome you back to the program, and it was interesting finding out that you had also been a warrant officer helicopter pilot in Vietnam.
Yes, I didn't know that about you either. That's interesting.
Well, we have to start wearing our hats with the little pinwheels on top of it so people knew we were helicopter pilots, I guess.
It's a dead giveaway.
It is. What class were you in at Walters?
I graduated in 69 and went to January of 69. I was in Vietnam. So flight school was 68, 69.
Okay. All right. I was just asking because I was a redhead at Fort Walters.
I wore a yellow hat.
Okay. So see, there we go. We'll have to do a story sometime about the hill up there at Fort Walters, which I think is now an industrial park. But let's just talk real briefly about your experiences in Vietnam. I know that you extended your tour, which kind of led to what you were able to do. But what were your missions when you were flying in Vietnam?
Well, the first tour was with the 116th Assault Helicopter Company at Cu Chi. And we did insertions and extractions and medevacs pretty much every day in a different part of Vietnam. It's what the 116th was what they termed a bastard outfit. So we would just go to work for whoever needed us. One day it would be the 25th Division, and the next day it would be Cambodian mercenaries, which were like 80-year-old guys and 15-year-old kids with flintlocks.
That's interesting.
I mean, it was truly an amazing, a very eclectic assignment.
That's interesting. Cu Chi was just up the road. I was stationed, my home base was in Long Binh, and then we worked out of a place called Quan Loi up by Tay Ninh.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And we did a lot of, we had one platoon that did a lot of insertions and stuff in Cambodia, and the other one did a lot of ash and trash and whoever else called. And, you know, you went off on those missions on a daily basis, never knowing where you were going.
Exactly. Amazing some of the assignments you'd get.
That's true, too. I'd love to see some of your photographs, probably of the stuff that you had to carry. So, and then you extended for an additional 6 months, correct?
That's correct. They came out with, they were having a lot of accidents in aviation, and they came out with a need for, if you signed up for a second tour as an experienced pilot, your second tour would be 6 months, and you'd get, I think it was a year, trimmed off your obligation to the Army.
Right.
I think I was the first guy in Vietnam to sign up for that.
You're one of the, I don't want to jinx anything, but an awful lot of people I know that did extend did not make it, which I thought was, you know, kind of pushing the envelope myself.
Yeah, there was that. But oddly enough, towards the end of my first tour, I was assigned out of the 116th to fly a two-star general, the General Richardson, the governor of Saigon, military governor of Saigon.
Okay.
And when he went to go home, he called General Abrams and said, the guy who was running the whole war, and said, I have your new pilot. I didn't even see orders. It was a two-star saying to the four-star, here's your new pilot.
Yeah.
So it could have been jinxed, but it turned out out quite well. Frustrating, though, on another level, flying with the generals and hearing what they had to talk about in their orders from bunker at the embassy.
I would think that would be interesting. You had a general's mission all as well in our company. I can't remember the name of the general because I wasn't the. That's where we did a lot of training for Peter pilots, and
right.
I don't remember the name of the general. I just remember Captain Rodriguez flew the general all the time, and the aircraft was a little spiffier than most.
Cleaner.
A little cleaner than all of them.
Fewer bullet holes, too.
That's very true, very true. But we did get to go all over the Saigon area and all around Three Corps, and it was quite the adventure, really, when we would go out and, like you did, you know, and talk to all the battalion commanders, brigade commanders, company commanders, and all
right.
these different things, and you, unfortunately, you had to go and sit and wait. But let's okay, so you survived. Yay.
Yeah.
How old were you when you were able to get out?
I was probably 21 at the end of my second tour.
I want our audience to understand it. He's 21 years old. You probably had somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000, 1,300 hours in Vietnam.
I think I left there with 13 or 14, yes.
Right. And you're 21 years old.
Right, yes.
That's cramming everything into a short time, period of time. All right, so when you left, you didn't come right home. You did something really unusual and I thought really interesting. So tell us about how you came home.
Well, I'd like to take credit for being proactive or ultra intuitive, but I wasn't. I was just lost. I knew that I had been through something I didn't expect, and it had changed me, but I didn't recognize all of the changes. I just knew, finally, I'm out of Vietnam, but I don't really want to go back to America because of the troubles there. So there was this, Pan American Airways had a flight 001, which went around the world. The ticket was good for a year, and you could get off in a country and stay there for a few weeks and get back on Pan Am Flight 1. And it was very much like a Eurorail pass for an airline. And I traveled by myself, and I believe because I was by myself, everywhere I stopped, people just sort of adopted me, pulled me into their lives for a few days or longer. And if you look at war as the absence of humanity, what really happened was humanity just started pulling me back.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize I didn't even know I needed healing, but I believe that helped me to get back to normal before I came back to America.
I just think that the whole concept of getting on a plane whenever you want to and getting off whenever you want to and hanging out in different parts of the world, which is what you did, and you found out more about humanity than you probably expected.
I think because of the way I was embraced almost everywhere I stopped, I found out a great deal about myself, which is why when my cousin Todd Maddox told me to write the book, it's why I felt, okay, maybe it's important. It has to be written painfully honest.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some recollections that weren't fun, but the people I met, different countries all around the world. I think I hit 15 or 16 different countries on that trip. For the most part, just wonderful people. And I don't know if they saw that I was in need or a wreck, but they just, out of kindness, pulled me into their lives and helped me get better. I'm pretty sure that's what it was. They helped me heal.
I think they must have picked up on something, because it seemed like everybody just kind of embraced you. Maybe because they knew that you were 21 and you'd been through hell and that you needed some help getting out of it.
They may have picked up on that. I wasn't wearing a uniform. I was in the civvies happily.
Mm-hmm.
But and I think, too, part of it had to be the fact that I was traveling alone. I never went into a restaurant already engaged in conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the wonderful thing about Europe, they don't have the same idea about space that we do over here. So you might have a table by yourself at first, but if it gets busy, the maitre d's can introduce a total stranger to you,
mm-hmm,
to sit at your table. So that was, I love that part.
And I would think
so
that was kind of cool. The idea of not coming directly home really resonated with probably a lot of veterans, because the vast majority of that came home from Vietnam were in, you know, in Vietnam, and then 24 hours later, we were sitting at the kitchen table with mom, dad, or a wife, or whoever it might be. And I don't think most of us were prepared for that.
No, we were not. And I think they're doing a better job today,
mm-hmm,
preparing people that go to combat to come back out. But the nicest compliment I've had about the book, I've had a couple of Vietnam veterans' families read it. And I've also had some younger people, kids coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan,
mm-hmm,
whose families have read it and told me, basically, thank you for showing me how my kid, my brother, my daughter changed in war.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't expect that, and it's a lovely compliment.
That is a compliment, and it does do that. We're talking with Richard Jellison. The book is entitled The Healing, and it's got a picture of a shot-up helicopter and then a nicer picture of a Pan Am Flight 001, which flew around the world, it seemed like, on a scheduled basis. And wherever it landed, you could get off, and then you could get back on whenever it came back again. Did it come through at most of these places every day?
I believe it was every other day, mm-hmm, and there was a Pan Am Flight 002 that went east from New York through the same cities.
Okay.
And the ticket there was good for a year as well.
Wow. So did you take the whole year to come home?
No, I did not. Perhaps 7, 8, 9 months. I don't remember exactly how long. I was kind of in a fog. But it was unusual. I've learned to not go directly home after that. But if you remember, America was having its own troubles then.
Well, it wasn't the most welcoming place, let's put it that way. And I think that we talk about that the anger of the people here in the States was kind of misdirected, and we didn't know what was going on either. I don't think most of us down on the line or out in the field, or whatever, didn't know what the political what was going on from at home. We just had our duty and our job, and that was all we were concerned about, was staying alive and keeping the guy next to you alive too.
Exactly, and that's one thing about Mark's book that's interesting is that we were kind of we flew war correspondents, and they just asked for a ride to go somewhere. But when they filed the reports, they went back to America, and our information, our news, was filtered to AFVN and Stars and Stripes.
Right.
And I think for morale purposes, we were not really apprised of all of the conflict and divisiveness in our country at that time until we got either on leave or got out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was difficult. I'm anxious to talk to Mark about that, with the correspondence. And I just thought both of you guys' books are really fascinating to me and interesting to me. And I think the regular world, in addition to veterans, would be very interested in reading both of them. So on your trip back, where were some of the places that you stopped off that were most memorable?
Some of the places that I stopped, I wouldn't go to again. definitely not alone. First comes to mind is Iran. I did go there, and it wasn't a warm welcome, but people almost everywhere I went were just friendly. It's human nature, and the innate kindness of people around the world. It was such a welcome after the tours in Vietnam. I stayed in places like Greece that people just pulled you into their dances, pulled you into their meals. So it was just a wonderful trip. Good for me.
Well, obviously it was good for you. What about you? You went to India, didn't you?
Yes, I did. That was it's in the book, I believe. I'll never forget that, from the cab ride from the airport to this very, very nice hotel. But there were just beggars, like 3 and 4 deep on the side of the road. Back then, I haven't been back to India since, but that was heartbreaking.
I can only imagine what that was like. I mean, there were plenty of beggars in Vietnam, but it doesn't seem like there were that many. And from India, you went over to Pakistan, correct?
Yes, I did.
How was Pakistan?
Another place I probably wouldn't go back to just now. But again, what I remember about the trip, it really wasn't a travelogue as much as it was being reintroduced to the kindness of people and the warmth of people, given a chance. They would rather be warm and friendly and outgoing than, for the most part, than being mean or surly or leave me alone. It was really wonderful. It was very helpful.
Well, I think what's so interesting about your story, Richard, is the idea of we had a guest on. I can't remember his name now, but the book was a who was it? It's a Greek god. No, I can't remember. Ulysses or Odysseus in Vietnam. Anyway, it was some Greek story, and it was written by a psychiatrist in a Boston VA, and he was talking about how warriors in ancient times in Greece and so forth would be separated from the civilian population after a battle or after a war, and they wouldn't reintegrate for usually up to a couple of weeks or a month.
Interesting.
And the idea was that they needed to come down.
Decompress.
And decompress. And I thought that was really interesting. And it sounds like this was something that you did, during your time period on Pan Am Flight 001, is just decompressing. And again, finding out who you were in relation to the person that went to Vietnam.
Right. There's a huge change when you go into combat. And, getting back acquainted with yourself was partly what happened on that trip, for sure. So, by accident, but
Well, I mean, it sounded like you had a plan because you in your book, you mentioned that you didn't necessarily want to go straight home.
No, I did not. America at that time didn't welcome Vietnam vets back very warmly. And it seemed like there was without the guns, it seemed like there was as much conflict and divisiveness going on in America as there was in Vietnam. So why go back to another war zone? And plus, I'm an explorer by heart. I really wanted to see the rest of the planet. So,
well, I think you did. It sounds like you got to hit all of these places. And if you were doing a travel log, you got to. You were in Spain. You were in.
Yes.
You were in France.
Yep.
Let me see as I go through here. You went to Africa.
Africa, Italy. In the book, I don't believe those countries are in the order I saw them. Rather, as I started to tell the story, it just came out, and it came out that way. But the combat elements that are in that book, I wrote when I finally got back to college. I ended up in a creative writing class and wrote short mm-hmm. stories about my combat experience. Didn't do anything with them, put them in a file. And then when my cousin convinced me that I had to write a book, I pulled them out again. Hadn't seen them, I don't know, years and decades. And some of that was painful to recall.
Mm-hmm.
But as I recollected from notes and such, the travel around the world, it was like therapy again. And that was rewarding. So I'm glad I did that book for sure.
Oh, I'm glad you did it too. I'm just, I'm flipping through it right now, and I'm gonna, you've got the stories of some of the things that you did while you were in Vietnam, and you use words as such as the innocence of an experience. And there was another line I just saw here, is the idea on your trip home is that you share your table with a wonderful stranger, possibly a new friend.
Yes.
And the juxtaposition of some of the graphic descriptions that you have in the book about what you saw while you were in Vietnam and some of the missions that you were on, and then this new mission that you went on.
Yeah, I couldn't tell the story. I wanted to because I didn't want it to be a war story. But
right.
After I got into it, I realized that I couldn't say anything about why I needed healing unless I showed some of the experiences that I had there, that we all had there. And fortunately, those short stories were in my file, and because it's been 50 years, so.
I know. How could that happen? How can it be 50 years?
I don't understand either.
I still feel like I'm 21 in my head anyway.
Yes. There's days when I feel like I just stepped down out of the Huey.
Yes, especially when you hear one.
Yes, exactly. An amazing sound, truthfully.
I am sure. Excuse me. All right, so where can we pick up The Healing?
The actual title is The Healing Pan American Flight 001, and it's on Barnes & Noble and Amazon and apparently several others, but it's self-published. It doesn't have a publisher. I'm hoping to find one, but for now it's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Well, that's good. I mean, it's out there and it's available, and I'd strongly recommend to our audience that anybody who's still having some issues with coming home, check this out. This is a good story. It's a feel good story when you're done with it. You put it down and you go, oh, okay. So I'm not the only one. And I think that's one of the things that I don't know if it was your goal with the book is that everybody heals in a different way. And
yes.
I think that this was a great way for you to do that.
I certainly hope so. I've got a couple of friends who were in Vietnam that encouraged me to do this, Bill Fortier and Tom Lasser.
Mm-hmm.
And they, we all had different experiences getting well afterwards, but they've been so supportive of this book and getting me to write it. So,
yes. So what are you up to in your civilian life today?
I have a documentary film series coming up on basically science based on our climate change, global warming, and endangered species and things like that. And I have a couple of scripted series that are being shopped through LA. One is about our country's commitment and search for our over 82,000 MIAs. The documentary that I did is a factual side of that. And the scripted series is based on those searches. And I was also brought in to help write a TV series about the golden age of Hollywood concerning Bill Boyd and his wife, Grace, and their fairy tale life they had and the amazing things they did with merchandising.
All right. Well, I think that's great. We need to talk more about those missing POWs, so I'll have to have you back on. Richard Jellison, thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio today. And the book is The Healing Pan Am Flight 001. You can get it on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. I encourage you to go out and get that. Thanks very much, Richard.
Thank you, Dale.
All right. We'll be taking a real quick break here, and then we'll be back with Mark Yolanka, and his book is Vietnam Bao Chi. And we'll explain what that is when he gets back here. You're listening to Veterans Radio. And we're back on Veterans Radio, and welcoming our next guest to our program today is Mark Yolanka, and his book is Vietnam Bao Chi. It's about warriors of word and film. And before I bring Mark on, I just wanted to read a little comment here by Joe Galloway, who's a, most of you have listened to Veterans Radio, you know, he's a regular guest here, and he was a war correspondent as well in Vietnam. And he writes down here that he was a civilian. So every combat operation we civilian war correspondents went on in Vietnam, we would meet a different kind of correspondent, the military reporters and photographers who shared all the risks and dangers and very little of the fame and glory. They were always there in the hottest of the action, capturing the images and stories of their fellow soldiers, Marines, sailors, airmen, coasties. In the worst of the action on landing zone X-ray in the Idrang Valley, I ran into two Army sergeants shooting film and photos for DASPO. Mark Yolanka has captured the stories of these brave military correspondents in Vietnam Bao Chi. I thank them for that. They deserve the recognition after all these years. This is Joe Galloway, co-author of We Were Soldiers Once and Young. And joining me on the line right now, he's been here before. He's a frequent guest, and I'm welcoming him back, is Mark Yolanka. Mark, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Dale, it's great to be back with you. It's been a few years and a couple of books down the road, but it's an honor to be with you. And I must say that since I caught the last few minutes of my good friend Richard Jellerson's segment with you, it was good to be, you know, with him in part. And I'm only thankful that I didn't have to be on the air with two Army Vietnam helicopter pilots at the same time. I wouldn't have measured up.
I think you would have. I think it would have done just fine. After all, you were a CW2 as well.
In the California State Military Reserve, absolutely. never got into aviation, but my service was basically in the what they call the CASMR. Was long after the fact. I was one of those who, and it haunts me still. I'm old enough to have served in Vietnam, but I, you know, sat the war out with a 2S deferment in university, and then in 1969 the lottery came out and I didn't have to worry about it anymore. And for many, many years I felt less of a person for not having served. And then when 9/11 came out, happened, I got a call from a friend of mine who was in the unit who did have an Army background, and he said, hey, our unit needs public affairs officers. And I said, Jim, you know, what are you talking about? I'm 50 years old. Of course, that was 18 years ago. And he says, doesn't matter. I think the mandatory out was 60 at the time. And so I put in a good 7 or 8 years, covering, MOBs and DMOBs, of our, brave men and women going over to Iraq and Afghanistan, and then got out to write books. But CW2 with the California State Military Reserve is correct.
That's right. And don't feel guilty at all. If my draft number had been higher, I wouldn't have been there too. The draft came out when I was in Vietnam, and we had a party to see how close we were to, oh my God, they're going to send us to Vietnam. So, you know, a little dark humor, black humor there, whatever you want to call it. But
right.
I think you've made up for it with this book.
Well, that's my mission and in life. As you know, basically, I think with the exception of one book, which is World War II related, that I dedicate to my late World War II veteran dad, all of my work is in some way related to Indochina. And, you know, I'm just glad that this one is out and that we can talk about it.
Well, there's a lot to talk about in here. So first of all, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, Vietnam Bao Chi.
Yep, Bao Chi, with the accents kind of rising in both words,
in both
of the two words. And what Bao Chi means is either journalist or press. And both the our guys in the military didn't wear that as a name tape, but the civilian guys, like Joe Galloway, whom you mentioned, mm-hmm. had that on the fatigues that they were, you know, able to come across in the black markets of Saigon and wear when they went out on patrols with helicopters, the likes of which you and Richard flew for their missions as well. Yeah, means journalist or press.
Well, I just think it's a great story. It's the warriors of word and film, and let's talk about these men and women that were involved in this and how they got involved with it. Like, before we talk about individual people, just tell me a little bit about what their missions were.
Well, pardon me for correcting you, but the women, I do have a section in the back of the book that does have some females in it, but these were men only, and their missions were basically to go out with the troops, on search and destroy, the whole gamut of missions that the regular sailors and Marines, airmen, sailors, and Coast Guardsmen did. They were along for the ride. The exception, I would say, or the difference, a better word to use here, between themselves and the civilian press corps was that along with their camera gear, which weighed them down, they had to hump the boonies too. So they had their rucksacks and everything that the grunts or boonie rats, as the Army called them, had on their persons, plus their M16s or their .45 caliber sidearms. And so they were literally more weighted down, with gear than the people they were covering, they had, I would have to say, a dual mission, especially the photographers, because they were in the thick of it too, and they often had to, make a decision: do I shoot the film or do I shoot my M16?
Right.
And there was some interesting responses that I got to the people that I interviewed in the book regarding that experience. Some of the photographers, for example, actually felt protected by the viewfinder that they were looking through.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, I've had a chance to talk with some of our current soldiers and Marines, men and women, who have been serving in the sandbox, as they call it, some of them combat camera people, and they don't share that same feeling.
I don't know about the idea of a protective bubble either.
But some of the most famous people that I interviewed, in the back of the book, for example, is a chapter regarding Eddie Adams,
mm-hmm.
the famous AP photographer who took that iconic photo of General Luan shooting that Viet Cong in the head on the streets of Saigon, which is a story in its own right, how that happened and the after effects of that.
Right.
He was the first one that I heard in a lecture out here in L.A., mentioned that, and a couple of the other photographers that I interviewed for the book felt the same as well, that there was some sort of distance between them and the images that they were capturing as the bullets were flying overhead.
Mm-hmm. I want to explain to our audience that these photographers and correspondents weren't just picked up in the company area and say, here's a camera, go and do it. They all went through schools and training to do these jobs, didn't they?
Absolutely right. Yeah, DINFOS, which these days is at Fort Meade, Maryland, at the time was at Fort Benjamin Harrison, Indiana. And they went through, and DINFOS, by the way, is the Defense Information School. So they went through training either as reporter writers or photographers, or what the guys who did the motion picture end of it called themselves, MOPIC photographers, did all their training at DINFOS. In the case of some of the units, in particular, you mentioned DASPO and Joe Galloway's you know, endorsement of my book. DASPO is the Division of the Army Special Photographic Office. They and a couple of other units went through their training at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. Before that, some of the guys that I interviewed were, you know, had worked on their high school newspapers or their college newspapers. Some had even, you know, worked professionally for the hometown newspapers or hometown TV stations. So they were not picked out of a crowd, you know, in that sense.
I was just interested when I was reading through this of all the background, the training that they had, and some of them had gone to, they mentioned that going through, I forget which school it was, but that was the best part of their training was to learn how to be a correspondent. I thought it was at Syracuse, but I can't remember.
Well, I know that Syracuse does have a program in particular for photographers, and two of the guys that I interviewed, mainly Ken Hackman, who's out here on my end of the country, who was an Air Force photographer, and he got up and in jets and in B-52s and such and took photos from the air, and Chip Maury, who was a naval, he was not a SEAL, but he humped, so to speak, with SEALs, but he did underwater photography in Vietnam and some land stuff. And both of them have taught classes both at DINFOS at Fort Meade in current times and at the Syracuse University Special School for Photographers for the Military.
I thought that was so cool. I didn't realize that the military had some of these schools even out there, and it really makes sense that they do. Of course, inside your book, many of these correspondents that you talked to mentioned Ernie Pyle,
as
their hero and, you know, person they wanted to emulate the most. Could you talk to our audience just briefly about Ernie Pyle to remind them of who he was?
Sure. Ernie Pyle, of course, was the preeminent correspondent during World War II. He wrote for the Scripps Howard News Service was the inventor of what they called the hometowner. Basically, he went from troop to troop and got their personal stories, and so you know, the folks back in Boise, Idaho, or Las Vegas, New Mexico, or Big Bear, California, where Richard calls home, could you know, learn about their sons and their daughters. And Ernie, of course, met his fate you know, in Japan towards the end of the year. Was killed by a Japanese sniper. I know you're when you talk about the influence Ernie Pyle had on these, I think the one that sticks out the most in my mind is Steve Stibbins. Steve was the first Stars and Stripes reporter in Vietnam. He was a Marine. I should say he is a Marine, because
yes,
you know how Marines are about that.
We know how they go.
Once a Marine, always a Marine, right? He was the first Stars and Stripes reporter in Vietnam. He was in there as early as 1962, and then did another tour for Leatherneck Magazine, which, of course, is a Marine publication. And then he hung up his uniform and did a third tour for the Associated Press. And his mission in life, I think, was to emulate the work of Ernie Pyle, and he did that. I met Steve, I guess totally by accident, back in 1997. Don't know how it happened, but somehow I got an invitation to attend a gala, if that's the right word, or a celebration for a book that came out then called, I'm trying to think of the name now, I've got it downstairs, and apologize for drawing a blank on it, but...
This is what we do now, so it's okay.
Okay, great. Anyway, it's a book that celebrates the 135 photojournalists whose lives were taken both in our Vietnam War and the French Indochina Wars. I got it now. It's called Requiem for the Photographers
who died
in Vietnam and in French Indochina and in Vietnam. Boy, I'll tell you, just drew a blank.
That's why you can't remember, because it's a really long title. I looked it up.
You did? Okay.
I was interested in getting it.
We were talking.
It's not in the middle. It's not in our public library, but I would love to get my hands on that. Wow, this is going really fast. We've got about 10 minutes to fill in. So let's start talking about these people. We're talking with Mark LaBlanca here on Veterans Radio. The book is Vietnam Bao Chi, and it's about the warriors of word and film, correspondence, mostly military correspondence. I want to sit down and interview every one of these people, and I think we'll do that off the air and, you know, put these all up as, I think they're just great stories.
Well, I'll be happy to make any connections that you'd like.
Let's start talking about some of your favorites then.
Well, Steve is one, because he goes back, way back. My friend Frank Lee, who's also in this neck of the woods down south of me in Orange County, was the, the first. Well, I think Frank thinks that he was the only Chinese American. Marine combat correspondent to have served in Vietnam, and at the end of the chapter, it's like he went through so much, in his tour that in a sense, just as Richard was saying at the end of your interview with him, it's like he could breathe a sigh of relief because he was home, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you title his chapter is called "He Had Survived."
Yes, and that's exactly how he felt. And one of the things I have to say is that as gruesome and as horror filled as the tours of these men were, a couple things come to mind. Number one, they did have a slightly different mission, I think, than the civilian press corps, whom many of them, not all of them, but many of them, got along with and worked together well with and went on missions together. Some of them, had a different feeling. But one of the things that I think came out in several of the interviews was the humor aspect. And, mm-hmm. and, Frank tells a funny story about he was from Mississippi, and found his parents moved to L.A. and enrolled him in what was then predominantly Jewish Fairfax High School. And he gets himself on the yearbook committee, gets appointed the guy who's going to go from class to class to sell the yearbook. And so what does he do? He puts on a Jewish yarmulke, the skull cap. And here comes this Chinese guy in these classes. And, of course, all the students busted out laughing. And Frank is quick to point out that year, Fairfax High School sold more annuals than in its entire history. So stories like that abound.
That is true. That is true.
Yeah. Again, he's one. Marv Wolf tells a story that, you as a helicopter would relate to. He was rescued by an H-13 helicopter after being stuck in the highlands, left behind, believe it or not, because the last helicopter on the mission didn't have room for the photographer or the rider. And an H-13 picked him up. And en route to his base, the cotter pin. And I will let you explain to the people listening what that is. I have a pretty good idea that without the cotter pin, you as a helicopter pilot or any helicopter pilot is in deep trouble, right?
Well, this particular cotter pin, I believe it held on the collective.
Yes.
And the collective controls your up and down movement on a helicopter. So if the cotter pin fell out and you'd be just holding a stick in your hand and not going anywhere. How did he replace that?
He gave the pilot the pin from a hand grenade.
Oh, that's right.
And, and held on to that hand grenade for dear life. And they're moving along now, and the pilot said to him, throw the grenade out the window. And Marv says, it's not safe. He knew that there was a 5-second timing on when those grenades, you know, would go off, and you know, a helicopter's not going to be able to skedaddle that fast to get out of the way of
H-13 for sure.
Yeah, what grenades can do. And the pilot said, no, throw it out. And he said, I'll go higher. It's not safe. Anyway, the gist of the story was they made it back to base, and Marv went running with this live hand grenade in his hand, and, you know, probably got all the looks in the world of people thinking, who the hell is this guy? And managed to you know, find some burly guy, some sergeant who was able to heave it over the hill, and Marv counted, you know, 1,001, 1,002, 1,003, boom, and his line was so much for 5-second hand grenades.
Right. Let's there are many stories like this in here. So again, yes. I encourage our audience, civilians and veteran, I think that you'll find it really great stories here. It's Vietnam Bao Chi by Mark Yablonka. That's Yablonka. Let's talk a little bit before we run out of time. I want to get to Eddie Carroll, because
okay.
There's a segment in there I'd like you to read to our audience.
Absolutely. It's in a moving place. It's towards the end of the book, and when Eddie sent me this letter, I mean, I not only did I choke up, I knew it had to go into the book. He writes on page 271. Mark, I've deliberated about sharing this with you. After our son left yesterday, and if memory serves, his son was headed to the Middle East, I thought I thought about all the guys I knew who did not come back whole. One such gentleman was Bradford Smith Ellsworth. He was a staff sergeant who arrived in country on September 30th, 1969. And joined the 600th Photographic Squadron as something of a squad leader. And Eddie, of course, was in the U.S. Air Force. We did not break down to squad groups. We worked as a crew. That system was what we inherited when I got there, and it worked great as far as I knew. I mentioned earlier that all of us carried combat cameraman ID cards, which were sort of priority passes to board virtually any aircraft, room allowing, to perform our missions. On October 11th, 1969, I was manifested on an in-country flight aboard a Caribou 123 STOL. STOL stands for Short Takeoff and Landing Craft, operated by the Australian Air Force. It was essentially a mail drop flight where they would do pilot training, make several stops on the all-night assignment, and kick out mailbags for the troops assigned to the various bases and camps. I needed a couple of hours and was trying out some new low-light techniques with black and white film. About 45 minutes before the flight, Staff Sergeant Ellsworth walked into the ready room and announced that I had been bumped from the flight in his favor. It got confrontational as I challenged his using rank to get on this flight and showed him my COMDOC card. He told me in very harsh terms what I could do with the card, and reminded me that as a career man, he could certainly take care of the paperwork another time. He never had that opportunity. The flight crashed on takeoff. There was talk that it took small arms fire during the run-up, but the aircraft was completely destroyed and all aboard were burned beyond recognition. They had to be identified by dental records. That experience taught me several things, Mark. Never, never argue with anyone who wants to take your seat on an airplane, and never, never take for granted how fragile life is. I carry a small printout of Brad Ellsworth in my briefcase as a reminder that there but for the grace of God go I. Brad is listed on the wall on panel 17W, line 65. Rest in peace, Brad. My life has been so filled with joy, and I never forget how many like Brad lost it all. Eddie.
Thank you. I thought that was a really very, very powerful piece, and many of us that served in Vietnam or served in war in general have similar stories that, you know, if instead of going right, you went left, and the guy who went right got killed. And so I just wanted you to share that with the audience. We've only got about a minute and a half to go. It's amazing how fast this went. But again, we've been talking with Mark Yolanka. The book is Bao Qi. It is B, accent mark, A-O, capital C-H, accent mark, I, Vietnam Bao Qi. Where can we find this book?
In a couple of places. I would encourage listeners to go to, the book is published by Casemate Publishing, Casemate Publishers, which is a UK company that has offices in Philadelphia. So if they go to the website of Casemate, C-A-S-E-M-A-T-E Publishers, and key in Vietnam Bao Qi, Warriors of Word and Film, they'll find it there. Also, they can go to my website, which is https://... warstoriespress.com. They'll be able to find it there, and they can drop me a note, and I'd love to hear from your listeners at any time and talk to them about how the book came about.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being on the program, Mark. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. I want to get back in touch with you and talk more about some of these documentaries that you've got coming up, and we can have you get you back on the program and talk about those.
I'd love to do it, Dale. It's great to be with you again, and great to be with your listeners, and I want to thank you very much for having me on.
Okay. That was Mark Yolanka here on Veterans Radio. Next week is our benefits program, so if you've got some questions, go to the website, veteransradio.net. Until next week, you are dismissed.